Are we on the brink of disaster? And if catastrophe is our fate, what can we learn about it? I am joined now by the acclaimed and best-selling author as well as internationally renowned thinker Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the author of a timely and highly readable new book, The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, $37, published by Knopf. The book discusses in great detail some of the stresses accumulating beneath the surface of today's global order, whether that be the gap between the rich and the poor, high energy consumption, climate change, and economic and demographic dichotomies between societies. The author takes us from the rise and fall of the Roman Empire to September 11th, to the SARS outbreak, to the Middle East, and to the slums of megacities in Latin America and Asia to vividly illustrate this. As well, he discusses the need for adopting a prospective mind so as to adapt to constant surprise and instability. Thomas Homer Dixon is the director of the Trudeau Center for the Study of Peace and Conflict at the University of Toronto. His previous book, The Ingenuity Gap, was a huge bestseller and won the Governor General's Prize. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Thomas Homer Dixon. Good morning, Professor Homer Dixon.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Are we living in a desperate time, or are you just being negative, I guess?
Well, I think it's I think there are a lot of warning signs around, and I'm very concerned. I have a 19-month-old son, my first child, a bit later in my life because I just turned 52, and I look at him every day and I wonder what kind of future he's going to have, because there's some big changes and big problems coming down the pike towards us.
When you say coming down the pike, how soon are we looking at some? We'll talk about specifics, but just in general, are we on the brink of catastrophe?
I wouldn't say we're on the brink, but my book has a multi-decade timeline. You know, I'm looking out probably 30 or 40 or 50 years. Certainly within his lifetime, many of the changes and problems I'm discussing in the book will become much more severe. But it's silly. It's easy to pigeonhole this kind of argument and caricature it, and people will say that, you know, that I'm declaring that there's going to be catastrophe around the corner, and I mean, it's possible, but I have no better crystal ball than anybody else. It's unlikely that things are going to unravel soon, but I would expect that there are going to be some severe problems at some point in the future.
But before we get into the book, I did find the book highly readable, even for dopes like me who find these things, these important subjects, hard to get into. Is it hard for you because you're in the world of academia to write for a general audience, or did you find it easy?
Well, you know, it's funny you would say dopes like me, because I start from the premise that every reader is basically a smart person. They may not be informed about these topics, but, you know, I treat all my readers with respect, which is one reason I have a lot of endnote material so that people can take a look and for themselves if they want to know where I found the information that I'm talking about. But the biggest challenge, of course, is to take a complex technical subject and make it live, make it alive, and make it interesting and understandable for people who aren't familiar with it. And that, I find, is enormously demanding. A single paragraph of a section on, say, economics or climate change can take me a whole day to write. But it's a very important thing, because these issues are fundamentally problems of democracy, and for democracies to work properly, people need to be informed about the challenges that their societies face.
Now, you begin with the Roman Empire. Do you compare where we are today with the rise and fall of the Roman Empire? What can we learn from that?
Rome interests just about everybody. You know, right from the time where children were fascinated by Rome, it somehow it just appeals to us or intrigues us in some deep way. And of course, I've been the same. I've always been interested in the factors that led to the collapse of Rome. And as I studied that topic more, I realized that there were some really quite intriguing parallels between that age, almost 2,000 years ago, and ours. And in particular, and I focus on the issue of energy and how energy was used by Rome and how eventually Rome didn't have enough energy to support its needs. And one of the things we have to realize is that every society, whether it's an ancient one or a modern one, becomes more complex and tends to use more and more energy over time as it becomes more complex, as the cities get bigger, as it has larger bureaucracies, as it has larger militaries, for instance. And Rome was the same, but the energy that it needed was principally food energy grown on fields. Basically, it was solar energy converted into grain that was consumed by people who built the empire. Eventually, Rome couldn't supply, it couldn't grow enough food, basically, and couldn't supply enough energy to maintain itself. And I think that in many ways we face a similar situation today in the world. Our societies are very complex and more energy intensive, but there's some real questions about whether we will be able to supply the energy they need in the future.
You identify five stresses that have accumulated and brought us to where we are today. I'll list them and then we'll go into them specifically and you can elaborate on them. The first, and I guess this goes into energy use in the Roman Empire, energy today with the scarcity of oil, economic stresses, the gap between the rich and the poor, there are huge population growths in I guess poor societies, and you compare that to population growth in, let's say, places like in North America. Mm-hmm. Environmental stresses, damage to the resources, which I think has gone on forever, I guess, in the last 30, 40 years, as well as climate change, global warming. Let's begin with energy and our use of energy.
Well, the big issue here is that we're about to go through an energy transition from a petroleum age to what you might call a post-petroleum age. That doesn't mean that oil and gas are going to run out, but they're going to become more expensive, and the best sources, the cheapest sources, are going to be harder, are not going to be available to us. It's going to be harder to find. And when we pass that transition, which will probably happen in the next decade or two as global conventional oil output starts to decline, we're going to have to make some very significant changes in our societies because the cost of energy will become much greater. In particular, the energy cost of energy, how much energy it takes you to actually get energy, is going to rise quickly. And we're not prepared for that transition at the moment.
Why aren't we prepared? Is that government's fault? Is that business for not adapting to technology, et cetera? Or?
I think, you know, all of us, and this includes the private sector, you know, we adapt very easily to the way things are, and we tend to assume that what looks real and permanent around us will last forever. And it was hard for us to imagine a post-petroleum age because we've all grown up in a time of abundant energy. But the evidence shows, and I detail it, you know, at length in the book, the evidence shows that that's going to end in the next little while. It could happen. It could start happening in the next couple of years. It certainly won't happen much later than about 20 years from now.
And do you see that throughout the world, or is it just in countries like Canada or the United States where we drive SUVs and the sort?
Well, it's all one world energy market now when it comes to petroleum products, and I look at the world as a whole, as one in a sense oil field, and so the projections I make are based on oil availability for the whole planet.
Now, the gap between the rich and the poor, we've heard that talked about for years and years and years. Nothing has gone on to bridge that gap, has it?
It's funny. It depends how you look at it. This can be a glass is half full or glass is half empty situation. Certainly, most people in the world are wealthier than they were. There are fewer people who are absolutely poor in the sense of making less than $1 a day. But my concern is with the gap between poor people in the world and rich people in the world. And in fact, you can pretty well divide the world's population into those two categories. There are not too many people in the middle. There are about a billion rich people and somewhere around 4.5 billion poor people. And 2.5 billion of those are very, very poor, making less than $2 a day. And that gap between the richest people, us basically, and the poorest people is growing, and it's growing fast, the absolute gap. And it's those disparities in a wired world where everybody can see what everybody else is doing, where the poor can see how the rich are living. It's those disparities that really drive a lot of animosity and a lot of anger.
Building that into demographics, I guess, are there more people, more poor people than rich people at a constant rate?
Well, what's happening is that the poorer populations in the world, although fertility rates are dropping everywhere, pretty well everywhere, the poorer populations in the world are still growing a lot faster than the wealthy populations. So we will see a transition now from a situation where we have about, say, one rich person for every five poor people on the planet. In about 20 years, we'll see one rich person for every seven poor people on the planet. And that ratio will continue to change until it's about one rich person for every eight poor people on the planet. And that means an increasingly unstable situation. You know, we live in a small place, and it's impossible to keep people from moving around. We have their huge migration pressures as people try to move from poor countries to richer countries, and that produces a huge amount of strain.
No, the other two that we'll talk about are environmental stresses. We've done damage to our resources for even with the rise of the environmental movement 20, 30 years ago. We're still not better off, I don't think. And the same with global warming, climate change. Talk to me about that and just how pervasive it's become.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I'd actually take issue with one thing you said there, although I think your general point is absolutely correct. In rich countries, when it comes to visible environmental problems, air, especially urban air pollution and water pollution, we've made huge strides, and you know, we have to give people credit for that. You know, in general, local and regional pollution in wealthy countries is much better than it used to be. It's a lot lower. But we've done that mainly by displacing our environmental impact away from ourselves in time and in space. In other words, take something like the catalytic converter, which is on all our cars now. It's helped clean up urban air pollution tremendously. It's had a huge impact. But those catalytic converters also make our cars less efficient. So they burn more gasoline, which means, all things being equal, they release more carbon dioxide, and we have a bigger impact on the climate. So we've pushed the urban air pollution problem away from us, so it's not visible, but it has a bigger impact on people elsewhere, and perhaps our children and our grandchildren. Now, that being said, overall, humankind's impact on the global environment has gone up pretty dramatically in the last 30 years, and especially in poor countries. When you look at impact on local water resources, cropland, and fuel wood, the strain in many poor countries is just phenomenal now. Most people in our countries don't realize that pretty close to half the world's population depends upon local water, cropland, and forests for their day-to-day needs. And in many, many places around the world, those resources are stretched beyond the breaking point now.
So what do we do then to alleviate these stresses that you've identified? What can people do themselves?
Well, I think it's very important to work as we can in all the various ways that we all know well, that we're told about all the time, to try to reduce our own environmental impact, to express concern about environmental degradation in far-off places, to try to influence government policy and aid to help with that. There are things that we can do to make ourselves better able to cope in the future if all of these accumulated stresses actually start to destabilize our world, which I think they probably will at some point. We can try to make our lives and our societies more resilient to breakdown of economic and technological systems, food supply, energy supply, and these will help us ultimately cope better if things don't go well in the future.
So are you suggesting then that we deserve a destabilizing world, that we would need that so that we could realize what was wrong?
Well, and this is really comes to, in a sense, the nub of my argument. I look at the gulf between what we need to be doing on something like climate change and what we're actually doing, and it's very discouraging. It's discouraging for just about everybody who's working in these areas, and it's true for just about all the other topics that I talk about, demography, economic problems, energy problems. We're just not making the progress on any of these fronts that we need to be making. Now, I don't want to discourage people and say, well, just throw up your hands. But I think we do need to start thinking about what will happen if and when in the future these problems combine in various ways to start producing major, say, economic shocks in our societies. Now, on those occasions, the crisis that develops might actually, in a sense, be good for us. It might produce motivation and opportunity to allow us to actually start making fundamental changes in the way we use energy, for example, the kinds of technologies we use in our world, the way we distribute wealth within and among our societies. I don't think major changes are going to happen until there is a crisis of some kind. And you know what? Everybody realizes that about human beings. You know, we live in deep in denial most of the time, and then we do something when there's a shock.
I'm talking with Thomas Homer Dixon, the author of The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, $37, published by Knopf. Visit his website and sound lead, homerdixon.com. That's one word, homerdixon.com. The price of gas went up recently, and trends say that they'll go up further. Is that some sort of, like, the sticker shock of that? Does that help, do you think, consumers and think of better things? But the price of gas went down recently, and people seem to be back to their old ways.
The long-term trend, I think, will be up. You just have to look at how much oil we're finding on an annual basis compared to how much we're consuming. On a global level, we're finding somewhere around 3 to 7 billion barrels a year, and we're consuming somewhere between 25 and 28 billion barrels a year. So we're consuming basically resources that we discovered decades ago in some cases, and that can't go on forever. So I think energy prices will go up and probably quite sharply. They might, I wouldn't be surprised if in 20 or 25 years, in real terms, energy prices are 10 times as higher than they are now. And that's going to force us to change the nature of our societies from the ground up. Everything from the way we design our houses and how much we travel, to the design of our cities and how spread out they are, to what we regard as entertainment and the kind of work we do. And if there were one thing that I could change in the world that would really wake people up and start to change behavior patterns, it would probably be energy prices. I think higher energy prices would do us a lot of good in a lot of ways.
It seems to me, reading the book, that apathy is the real enemy here. How do we combat that? And I guess by adopting a prospective mind, is that correct?
That's right. And I think apathy and denial are fundamentally the real enemies. And they're quite understandable and very human responses to difficult problems, especially when there are very powerful economic and political interests that don't want to see change, especially interests relating to, for instance, the structure of our economies, big corporations and unions, and also energy producers. My idea of a prospective mind suggests that the place we need to start to get ready for what is liable to be a pretty volatile future is inside our heads, and we need to recognize that surprise is going to be a common feature of the future. We shouldn't be surprised by surprise. There will be sharp, sudden changes and shocks that will seem to come out of nowhere, only if you're not aware of what's going on in the world at all, but which are probably in most cases almost unpredictable. And the prospective mind will, if we adopt it, will encourage us to think down the road, try to anticipate what we might need in different circumstances in terms of resources, in terms of networks of support we might need within our societies, and start organizing among ourselves plans for how we would respond in different difficult circumstances. The time for us to be prepared for crisis is not when the crisis occurs, it's well before the crisis, and I think we've got lots of warning signs that things might get difficult in the future.
Two events that pick out from recent memory, September 11th and the SARS outbreak in Toronto. Do you think if those events happened today, we are better prepared because of how we handled it then?
They're good questions. I think we've done a lot of preparation or a lot of work to try to prevent something about like 9/11, specifically a 9/11 type attack. But of course, the thing that made 9/11 so appalling is that we didn't anticipate that kind of attack, and I would expect that future attacks may come in the form that we don't anticipate fully. So we're constantly sort of preparing to fight the last battle. If there were a major terrorist attack now, in terms of the vulnerability of our societies, in terms of how disruptive it would be, I don't think we're that much better off. We've left many of our critical infrastructures in more or less the same shape as we did before. They're about as brittle as they were before, and as likely to be shut down by major attacks. Now, the world economy as a whole was actually quite resilient after 9/11. My concern is that the future attacks may actually be quite a bit larger, and it's not clear in total, when you look at the whole world or our larger economies, how resilient they'll be in the face of larger attacks. SARS is an interesting case. I think that we actually have learned a lot in specific places about how medical systems should respond to SARS. I think if there were an outbreak of avian flu, we in Toronto and southern Ontario would actually probably be pretty well prepared for it. Lots of work has gone on at making hospitals and healthcare systems more resilient in the face of that kind of challenge. So there's a good example of what I call catagenesis, which is renewal in a sense through breakdown. We had a crisis in our medical care system in Ontario, and in the end, lots of changes were made that will make it better in the future if a similar such a crisis occurs.
So do you think it'll get worse before it gets better?
If you were going to, I guess I could have used that as a book title almost. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But a fundamental point that I make in the book, and this is really important, it turns out that the most adaptive systems that scientists have discovered, these would be, for instance, ecological systems and even some kinds of economic systems, tend to go through cycles of growth, increasing rigidity, breakdown, regeneration, and regrowth. Breakdown is a normal part of the process, not catastrophic breakdown, but just various forms of disruption. What the famous Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. He regarded that as a normal part of the dynamism of a modern capitalist economy. And creative destruction it turns out to be an essential part of the adaptation of any complex system that deals with a changing environment well. And we're not used to that. We like to keep everything the same when it comes to social and political affairs. And we have to realize, and that's part of what I mean by the prospective mind, we have to realize that sometimes we have to go through a very rough spot in order to adjust to a new world.
Ted, I want to ask you one last thing before I let you go, and that is, we looked at governments in crises, during crises, and we're speaking on the heels of an American election and possibly a Canadian one in the next year or so. Do you think that we need to change the kinds of governments that we elect, or do we have to change government itself?
I think that we need to start thinking about fundamentally new political institutions for our societies. The political institutions that we have in Western societies, kind of a Westminster parliamentary system, if you want to call it that, really evolved in the 18th and 19th centuries at a time when the fastest movement by people was really on foot or by horseback, and almost all information was communicated verbally. Now we can get to the other side of the planet in a day. People have computers that have enormous calculating and analytical ability, and we transfer information from one side of our country to the other by the terabyte. It's a completely different world now. Individuals and citizens are much more powerful than they used to be, and I think overall our political institutions are no longer well adapted. So one of the things that I try to talk about at the end of the book is how we might develop a parallel problem-solving process based on an internet architecture that would allow for more generalized democracy involving very, very large numbers of people that's relatively independent of our current formal political institutions. I don't want to throw them out by any means. I mean, they're very important and often they work well. But for some kinds of problems like we're seeing now and like the ones I talk about in the book, I think that we need new approaches, and that's something I talk about towards the end of the book.
Well, people should pick up this book because it is, as I said, highly readable, but it's fascinating and interesting and I think important. Ted, thanks so much for joining us today, and good luck with this book.
Thank you very much.
It is a fascinating book, and do pick it up, an important book. The Upside of Down Catastrophe, Creativity, and the